For my part, I think belief in God lost whatever rationality it once possessed when it was discovered that the earth was not the centre of the universe. The words of Bertrand Russell, philosopher I expect many of you have heard of, and he's expressing a sentiment that in the popular mind at any rate is regarded as conventional wisdom, that Christianity and science are somehow mutually contradictory, that the erroneousness of the former of Christianity has been conclusively exposed by the human progress in the latter field in the last 500 years or so. Well, this evening I want to try and make a small contribution to the defence of the contrary point of view. I was trained as a scientist, and I still have an enormous interest and respect for the scientific enterprise, but I'm a Christian too, and it's my conviction that these two great interests of my life are not antagonistic to one another. They can be integrated into a single worldview, which in fact is infinitely richer and more satisfying than the atheistic scientific stance which I once adopted. Now, I want to illustrate that tonight with reference to one particular debate, which I suppose in many minds epitomizes the collision between science and faith, and that's the whole question of Genesis, in particular Genesis chapters 1 and 2. There are no chapters in the Bible that have occasioned more controversy over the last one or 200 years than these very first chapters of all. For the skeptic, these are the chapters that he turns to when he wants to find undeniable evidence that the Bible makes mistakes and that Christians are obscurantists and fools. For many Christians, on the other hand, these chapters provide them with the touchstone of biblical inerrancy. The reason is quite simple. The book of Genesis, as its name rather implies, is the book of beginnings. It introduces countless themes that, like threads in a piece of material, are taken up by later books in the Bible and woven together into the whole tapestry of Christian revelation. It sets the scene for the whole drama the Bible has to tell us about. So to try to understand the Bible without first reading Genesis 1 and 2 is a bit like coming into a theatre halfway through the play. You're forever asking, what's it all about? The plot is bound to confuse you. But the book of Genesis, in many respects, sets the agenda for the whole story. But of course, in the last couple of hundred years, a new version of beginnings has become popular, a version based not on divine revelation in the Bible, but on scientific investigation, a version which it is claimed appeals not to faith, but to reason. And this new book of Genesis, if we may call it that, seems in many areas to contradict the account given to us in the Bible. Here's a very simple outline of those two accounts, and the differences between them are pretty self-evident. According to the scientific account, and the years that I'm quoting here are, debatable by some of you experts, I know, I'm only talking in round figures. The Big Bang, perhaps 20,000 million years ago. The Sun's formation, 4.5 million years ago. The hardening of the Earth's crust, about 3.5 million. First life appears, maybe 600 million years ago. Coal deposits, 300 million years ago. Dinosaurs, which all little children seem to be enamored with just these days. I don't know why this fascination with dinosaurs. I was seeing that the National Geographic magazine has a whole section on dinosaurs in North America this month. I don't know if you've seen that. Just to show they have everything else, they have dinosaurs as well in North America. Old Stone Age men, in inverted commas. I prefer to call them hominids, for a reason that will become apparent later. 2.5 million years ago. The famous Ice Ages stretch from that period right down to the end of the last age, about 10,000 BC. Neolithic, new Stone Age man, modern man, as we might say, beginning around 10,000 BC. There's the scientific account of the beginnings of the universe, of the earth, of animals, and of man. And the Bible's account? It all happened in 7 days, says Genesis 1. On the first day, the creation of light. On the second day, sky and sea. On the third day, land and vegetation. On the fourth day, the stars. On the fifth day, marine creatures and birds. On the sixth day, land creatures and human beings. As for modern man, Genesis 2 records that the first modern man and his wife, Adam and Eve, were placed by God by special creation in a garden in the east, watered by four rivers, two of which are known to us today, the Tigris and Euphrates. It's easy to see how superficial gaze those two accounts are completely different, if nothing else, in their timescales. But I want to suggest to you that the collision is not so intense as people sometimes make out. Three issues actually complicate this whole debate. The first issue that complicates it is the inconclusiveness of much of the scientific evidence. The impression is often given, of course, particularly to children at school, that science now has a complete understanding of the origin of the universe, which is settled beyond all reasonable doubt. But that simply isn't so. In just about every area of the discussion of origins, there are huge questions still, huge debates still, within scientific circles. This notorious theory of evolution is a classic example of that. The evidence for evolution is not as overwhelming as biological textbooks sometimes imply, and when one talks to senior biologists, they're usually fairly willing to admit that there are big holes in the theory, big uncertainties. The new science or taxonomy of cladistics, a new way of classifying living things, collides with much conventional evolutionary history. The fossil evidence is not as complete or as unambiguous as sometimes suggested. Mathematical calculations about the probability of the generation of life from inorganic materials stretch the plausibility of many scientists to breaking point. We could go on and on. Over the whole of the theory of evolution, not just of animal life, but also of geology, there's the uniformitarian kind of hypothesis, that is, that everything has gone on by gradual changes, that huge catastrophes have not dislocated the record in any major way. The scientific evidence up to date does have problems, and honest scientists will admit that there is a question mark still over much that they say about the beginning. Now, of course, some Christians seize eagerly upon such an admission. Ah, they say, oh, well, it all happened in 7 days after all. Big sigh of relief. But to be fair, you see, the case for the Bible's account is not as unambiguous as some people make it either, because there are genuine problems of interpretation that surround these early chapters of the book of Genesis, which were recognized by thoughtful exegetes, expositors of the Bible, long before this current debate took off. For instance, what literary form, what literary genre do we ascribe the book of Genesis to, and particularly that early chapter of Genesis? Is Genesis 1, for instance, with its talk of 7 days, is it poetry? Like David's Psalms. There is a certain parallelism, if you think about it. On the first day, light is made, and on the fourth day, light bearers in the heavens are made. In the second day, the sky and the sea are made. On the fifth day, creatures of sky and sea are made. In the third day, land and vegetation appear. On the sixth day, land creatures appear. Three pairs. That feels rather like a poetic structure. If it isn't poetry, is it apocalyptic vision? In the Bible, we sometimes do have visionary experiences given to prophets with bizarre symbols in them. The book of Revelation is a classic example of that sort of literature. Could it be that Genesis 1 or Genesis 2 belong to this kind of visionary experience? There are symbols, for instance, that appear in Genesis 2 which reappear in the book of Revelation, like the tree of life and the serpent. Or is it a prophetic message? A word from God about the past, as the prophets of Israel were sometimes favoured with words of God about the future. It is, after all, a book which is ascribed to the greatest prophet of them all, to Moses. Quite often, when prophets give a word about something which God is doing in history, they time collapse it. It's very hard to work out the actual chronology of what they're talking about, because they see very distant things as if they may be very near. Maybe it works backwards as well as forwards like that when you're a prophet. Or is it a theological tract, Genesis 1 and 2? Is it deliberately composed to counter the mythological accounts of origins which threaten the Hebrew religion in the ancient world, stressing the supremacy and priority of one God, Jehovah, over all other forces of astrology or what have you, which were characteristic of the idolatry of the ancient world? Interestingly, the one character category which is very hard to place Genesis 1 in is history. Because, of course, even biblical history has to have a historian. And a historian is a person who is either a witness of certain events himself or has access to other human accounts of incidents. Historians deal with received human tradition about what happened. If we're going to say that Genesis 1 is history, we've got to say that somebody was around watching. And that clearly can't be so. Genesis 1 has to have been given in some kind of supernatural way to whichever author, to the author that originally composed it, assuming that may not have been Moses. Moses may have received it from somebody else even prior to him. A vision, a prophetic message, a theological tract, whatever it is, it can't be eyewitness observation, can it? Now, we may have personal convictions, of course, about how Genesis 1 should be interpreted. But unless we want to set ourselves up as the Pope, who is able to define how the Bible should be interpreted for all Christendom, at least so the Pope thinks, unless we're going to set ourselves up in that kind of way, we can't really, I think, insist that our interpretation of Genesis 1 must be the normative one for all Christians. We have to leave room for people to discuss the matter and think about the matter. So there are two overlapping areas of uncertainty. There's the uncertainty in the scientific evidence, which until someone invents Doctor Who's time machine, will always remain with us. We should never be sure, whatever paleontologists may have to say about the matter. It's the very nature of looking into origins that you have to extrapolate back from very limited information an awful long way. And there will always be uncertainty, therefore, in the scientific account of origins for that reason, I think. And that overlaps with this uncertainty we have in how these early chapters of the Bible are intended to be interpreted by God and by their original authors. We don't have a straightforward contradiction then. And the problem, I suppose, is how do we resolve such a tenuous debate? There have been a variety of attempts to bring science and Genesis 1 together, and they fall into two groups. Some Christians accept the evolutionary theory of origins. They judge it to rest on a sufficient basis of scientific evidence to place it beyond reasonable doubt, even if some of the details are still open to debate. Some of these Christians would treat the Genesis account, therefore, in a totally non-literal way. They would say it was designed to teach theology, or that it was poetry, that it wasn't intended to give us a literal picture of how the world was made. Some would adopt what's called a position of theistic evolution. That is, they believe that evolution was the mechanism God used to create the world, and that the 7 days, maybe, represent 7 great ages over which the process of evolution took place. It is interesting, after all, to notice that according to Genesis 1, creation doesn't take place in a single fiat. It does take place progressively over a period of time, rather than by a sudden snap of God's fingers. And such writers point out with some justification that evening and morning were the first day can't be taken literally until there's a sun to define when day and night end, can it? I mean, clearly the very structure of the thing suggests that you can't take it exactly literally. One interesting speculation is that maybe the prophet, say Moses, was actually shown the origin of the world as if he were an eyewitness observer. But in this sort of time-collapsed way, so that he saw it from the big bang of light energy right through to the emergence of the human race over the period of a 7-day visionary experience. So the 7 days are not days of creation, but 7 days of revelation. There are many Christians, like me, who'd be prepared to accept the evolutionary sort of theory as a mechanism by which the species were produced in the world and harmonize it in one or other of these sorts of ways with Genesis 1. And it seems to me their position, given the limitations of the scientific evidence and the difficulties of the biblical interpretation, is a permissible one. Other Christians, on the other hand, reject the evolutionary model, at least as a complete explanation. They feel that science just hasn't taken seriously enough the possibility of other ways of understanding the origin of the world. They point out very validly, for instance, that if 7-day creation had taken place exactly as Genesis 1 says, It would be a very extreme form of anomaly in world history, which science would find it very hard to investigate. For instance, supposing God made a mountain in one day and showed it to a geologist. The geologist would certainly say it had been there a million years. Creation implies a kind of built-in age. Raises the old question of how old Adam was when he was made, and whether he had a navel or not. Did the trees in the Garden of Eden have rings? That sort of thing. Again, these sort of folk would point out that time is not continuous and unvarying quantity. We begin to realize this the more we understand about the physical universe. Since Einstein's famous work on relativity, we know now that the rate at which time passes depends on the distribution of matter in the universe and its velocity. They might say, for instance, that in the cosmic non-Euclidean upheaval of a creational situation, who can say what might or might not happen in 7 days? We're really talking beyond our knowledge. However, I think it's only fair to say that there is a good deal of evidence against this kind of young Earth theory, as it's sometimes called, that wants to take the 7 days literally. And speaking personally, I don't find it a very satisfying harmonization. When you look, for instance, into the field of geology, and you notice the sort of sedimentary deposits, the coral reefs, those coal seams I mentioned, how thick they are, it's very hard to believe that these things didn't take many, many hundreds of thousands of years to form. When you look into the field of astronomy and you realize that some of the stars are so far away, the light from them has been traveling millions of years. If the Earth is as young as some of these people say, then God not only had to make the star, he had to make the light all the way from the star to, you know, about 10,000 light years away from the Earth, so that the light could now be reaching us, because that's only how old the Earth is. Same goes for radiometric dating of rocks and so on. Though you can quibble about the accuracy of these things within a 10 or 25% sort of range, the sorts of rates of decay that would be needed to explain the observation of radioactive bearing rocks and correlate that with a young Earth would mean that... But I think it would probably mean that our Earth would have been bathed in radiation. They'd have been decaying so fast in order to explain the state of affairs that we have. And I suppose, supremely, there's the fact of the fossils, the dinosaurs. I mean, where do they fit? Theorists of the seven-day creation generally believe these things are to be fitted into a great catastrophe, the flood, Noah's flood, recorded in the Bible in Genesis 6. During this unparalleled upheaval, some of them would say, the geological strata were dislocated and huge changes took place. The topography of the Earth was completely transformed. And so changes took place in a very short space of time, which the uniformitarian theory of geology usually suggests took millions of years. And the fossils, well, they are simply the animals that perished in the flood. They are nowhere near as old as traditional evolutionary theory suggests, because the strata of rock they are in are nowhere near as old as that theory suggests. But I think one has to say that, again, that theory takes a lot of swallowing. The number, the sheer number of fossils that are to be found seem far too many to be a single generation. And it is hard to believe that Noah took dinosaurs into the ark, or to understand exactly why God didn't require him to have an aquarium in the ark. I mean, there are species of fish which are extinct too. They never perished in the flood. They didn't have to. They could swim. So there are an enormous number of questions, I think, that are unanswered by that sort of theory, although it is supported by some weighty and distinguished Christians, and I think one ought not to laugh at it too contemptuously. Any scientist who dismisses a theory contemptuously is not doing very good science. We need to think about alternative theories. It's so stupid to say, oh, I believe in evolution, and nothing you say is going to convince me otherwise, as it is to say, I believe in seven-day creation, and nothing's going to convince me otherwise. So we have an open question, in a way. We have two areas of uncertainty, which we struggle with. The uncertainty of the scientific evidence, theories which have a lot of evidence in favor of them, but are far from being proved. And we have the testimony of Genesis 1 and 2, which could be interpreted in a variety of ways, all of which, I think, could be arguably said to do justice to their authority as an inspired book, since we must always take into account that the literary genre of the Bible when we interpret it. Does it matter? Does it really matter, then? Can we just remain agnostic on the whole question? Not totally, I think. The reason we've got to think about it and wrestle with it centers on the fact that, of course, at the end of this chain of origins that we have listed here, both in the scientific account and the Bible account, something very significant and important as far as you and I are concerned happens. The human race begins. Who am I? Why am I here? What sort of creature am I? According to the scientific account, the human race is the pinnacle of the evolutionary tree as far as it's gone. But we are fundamentally a product of chance. We are just another animal species. We happen because perhaps the circumstances that presently prevail on the planet Earth favour us. We have succeeded in becoming the dominant species, like the dinosaurs were once. Maybe we won't hold that privileged position forever, though. Maybe the ecology will change, the climate will change, and like the dinosaurs, we will be wiped out. Maybe the ants will take over, or somebody else. But that's all we fundamentally are, just another animal species. The Bible has a very different account of the human race, though, doesn't it? It insists we human beings are significant. Different, in a very special way. Now, of course, the story of Adam and Eve that we find in Genesis 2, again, has been understood in various ways by Christians. Some have understood it symbolically, as a mythological and allegorical account of every man. Adam symbolizes all of us, how we decay from innocence to guilt. There are elements in the story which support a non-literal interpretation. We've already mentioned the tree of knowledge and the talking serpent, which seem, at any rate at a superficial glance, to have more in common with legend or apocalyptic vision than with serious history. But there are strong arguments, in my view, for regarding Adam as a concrete historical individual. Now, I'm always, people, when I say that to people, they always sort of raise their eyebrows, at least those who are not from a sort of Bible Christianity background always raise their eyebrows, as if someone could seriously hold such a view and be serious about their science too. But I feel that's actually by far the best way to harmonize Genesis and the scientific account, to take a view of Adam as a concrete historical individual. That certainly does seem to be the assumption of the book of Genesis, you see. From Genesis chapter 2 onwards, the Bible does seem to be talking history. There's no sharp dividing line between Adam and his ancestors. The Bible gives us a genealogy of Adam, linking him with Abraham, and then with later figures of Jewish history. It's quite clear the Bible itself believes he was a historical individual. The Garden of Eden is located in Genesis, geographically in a known area, somewhere in the steep lands of Turkey, where the sources of the Tigris and the Euphrates are. And indeed, the way that the story of Genesis 2, verse 4, is recounted in Genesis, it begins this way. This is the genealogy of. This is the account of, maybe. That normally, in the book of Genesis, is an indication that the writer is citing some kind of source, some kind of historical source or tradition. You find that phrase many times. It always is linked to some kind of piece of received history that the writer is going to compile into his book. So if we just look at the book of Genesis and say, well, what sort of genre does the story of Adam fit into? Where does it fit within the normal canons of biblical understanding? I think one would have to say there's a strong ground for believing that it has a historical foundation, that that's how the author intended it to be read. I wouldn't say the same about the 7 days of Genesis 1. It's much more uncertain what sort of genre that fits. But from Genesis 2, where you're talking about Adam, we seem to have an account of human beginnings which rest on memory and tradition. And that, of course, may be why stories like Adam and Eve are to be found in many ancient peoples, not only the Jewish people around the world, precisely because it does rest on memory. If so, where does it fit into the account of human beginnings that science presents? Where does it fit onto this left-hand side? Where does Adam come, if you like? We know now, of course, that archaeology has discovered bones which are anatomically classified as human, but which, according to accepted theories of dating, are up to a million years old, or perhaps even more. Old Stone Age hominids, 2.5 million years ago, perhaps as long ago as that. I think we have to say, self-evidently, that Adam could nowhere be that old if you read Genesis 2 as history, as I do. The genealogy that leads from Adam to Noah and on to Abraham maybe allows us to think that Adam existed somewhere in the range 10,000 BC, but nowhere a million BC. You just can't stretch the evidence that far. But then it would be most unrealistic if Genesis did place Adam a million years BC. For when you read Genesis 2, it's quite clear that Adam was a gardener. The text says he was placed in the Garden of Eden to look after it, to till it and keep it. We're told his son Cain built a city, that his fairly close descendants began to forge bronze and iron. In archaeological terms, that means Adam was a Neolithic human being. According to present theories, the end of the last ice age, such men as existed, assuming for a moment they were men and did exist, were hunters living in caves. But for some reason, at the end of the last ice age, for a reason which is not at all understood, I think, even now, after hundreds of thousands of years of this caveman, old Stone Age existence, suddenly human civilization began in its proper form. Human beings began to farm. Cities began to be built. Technology began to be developed. Within quite a short space of time, man was working in metals. This was the Neolithic Revolution, far more dramatic cultural revolution than has taken place at any other time in human history. And the date of this extraordinary revolution was sometime around 10,000 BC. Where did it begin? Well, that's still a matter of dispute, of course. But there have always been very good grounds for believing that Neolithic culture may have begun in the Middle East. Certainly some of the earliest Neolithic cities have been discovered lie in that area. That being so, I don't see any real difficulty in identifying where the Bible believes Adam belongs in the pattern of human cultural development that we've been able to unearth with our archaeology. As far as the Bible is concerned, the history of the human race begins with Neolithic human beings, 10,000 BC. That's who Adam is. The Bible doesn't have any interest in what happened before then much. It's all subsumed under those 7 days of creation. The dinosaurs and all that. Even these old Stone Age hominids, what are we to make of them? There are two approaches. Again, it depends what your view is regarding those early chapters of Genesis. The young earthers, the people who want to say, well, the 7-day creation is still believable. We don't have to go with this earth being 3.5 million years old and so on. They would want to argue that these bones that have been dug up, which are human, are the bones of men who perished in the Great Flood. Human fossil remains of that great catastrophe. They seem older, they argue, because the geology of the earth was transformed during the period of that cataclysm. Those who take an old earth view, however, as I do, who believe the world is very, very old as scientists believe, and who accept in broad outline the evolutionary model, though maybe we have big question marks about many aspects of it in detail, they would see this rather as God creating a new man, Adam, who was the founder of the human race, and that before his coming there were some highly developed animals, or maybe pre-Adamic men. I don't think we really know which we would want to call them. But they existed before Adam, and the Bible has no interest in them. They don't feature in the history of the modern human race, all of which developed out of that new initiative that God took with Adam and Eve. It is certainly true that the human race is one species. It's certainly true that the human race that exists now all over the earth must originally have come from a single gene pool, I think. For we are interfertile, we have the same blood groups, though our skins are a different colour. Such minor changes as that need a very little time to develop, as anybody who breeds animals knows. Now, the Bible is perfectly plausible when it says the whole of the human race developed from an original gene pool, indeed from an original pair. There's no essential implausibility about that. And all the Bible says is that that original pair was a special creation of God, that he located them in the Middle East. And that was the fount of the history of the human race which we belong to. Again, you may say, well, this is very interesting. It's nice to hear a Christian say that I don't have to believe in a seven-day creation if I'm going to be a Christian. I could possibly believe the earth is 3.5 million years old and still be a Christian. That may be reassuring for some. You may be saying, well, it's nice to hear a Christian say that, you know, it's possible to locate Adam and Eve historically within the archaeological timescale, to fit Adam and Eve in, to Neolithic, the dawn of Neolithic culture in that way, that maybe that makes quite good sense. But again, does it really matter? Is it really important? Well, it's important for two reasons, isn't it? It's two reasons, first of all, because if we can't integrate our science and our faith together, we live in boxes. We are the sort of people who come to church on Sunday and we think one way, and then when we, for the other 6 days of the week, particularly if we're students or in academic work, we think another way. And that doesn't really do justice, does it? It doesn't have integrity. It's vitally important, surely, that we have some basis, some unified field of knowledge into which to fit what we believe, both about the Bible and about God and about science. But more than that simple question of integrity, there are some very serious practical consequences of the Bible's account. For if it is believable that we are descended from Adam, just as the Bible says, maybe it's also believable that the fundamental problem of the human race is what the Bible says it is. Let me give you an illustration to explain what I mean. Supposing I received a mysterious letter. It's written in an unknown hand, in a foreign language. It bears an exotic stamp. I could give it to my scientific friends, and perhaps they could tell me a lot about the letter. They would do various tests on the ink to try to establish how long ago it was written. They would examine the stamp and try to identify the country of origin. They might examine the handwriting and give me a personality profile of the author these days. But if I said to them, well, that's all very interesting, but what does the letter say? What does it mean? I suspect they would shrug their shoulders and tell me to go to the linguistics department. In the same way, I think scientists may have their learned judgments about when and where the human race began. But the most vital question for you and me, in regard to this whole question of origins, is what do we mean? Why are we here, we human beings? What's our destiny? What's our significance? There's no way experiments on fossilized bones can answer that kind of question, is there? When scientists pass opinions on such matters, they're going way beyond their science into the realms of philosophy and metaphysics and, of course, religion. But I suggest to you there's no way you and I can avoid asking such questions. For the simple reason, we are human beings. This is not just a speculative question for us, it's an existential question. It hinges on our self-understanding. We demand to understand ourselves. Whatever the truth about evolution and origins may be, we are different from the animals, at least in this, aren't we? We are not content simply to survive. As self-conscious agents, we demand to understand ourselves. We demand to know why we are here and what we should be doing with our existence. And we can't really make sense of our existence without an answer to those questions. And science can't tell me what the meaning of this mysterious epistle of the human race is. But the book of Genesis can. The book of Genesis can because it's a word of revelation from God, our Creator. Now, when you don't understand a play, you don't ask the critics, you ask the author. When you don't understand yourself, don't ask a scientist, he's as confused as you are. Ask your maker.
That's what the book of Genesis is, a word from our Maker to interpret our existence to us. We need to know the answer to these questions. If we didn't need to know them, he wouldn't have bothered telling us. If we would have worked it out on our own, there would be no book of Genesis necessary. But no, God has spoken to deliver us from our ignorance about our own destiny and meaning as human beings. What does he tell us? He tells us he made us in his own image. That's what he tells us. In the image of God, he made them, male and female. It's an enormously important observation on the part of the book of Genesis. For it means, you see, that we cannot understand ourselves by analogy to animals. Of no animal was this said. The animal model for a human being will always fall flat. We will never be satisfied with it. Because according to the book of Genesis, we are qualitatively different from anything else in the whole of creation. It's only possible to make sense of a human being in the light of an analogy of a likeness to God himself. It was in his image we are made. It's that special relationship to God which is the root of all the unique features of our existence, not least our intuitive sense of our own significance and destiny. We may be made out of the dust. The book of Genesis says we are. But we're not just dust. We may have animal life. Indeed, the book of Genesis says we do. But we have a capacity also for more than animal life. To say that you and I are made in the image of God is not to contradict the scientific model, but it is to complement it in a way which is absolutely fundamental and necessary. And if you take it on board, if you take that view of yourself on board, there's no telling where it might lead you. It might lead you all the way to becoming a Christian. I'll finish with a little story. Forgive me, those of you who have heard it before. Once upon a time, there was a shoal of tadpoles. These tadpoles lived in a pond, and they were very contented in their pond, except for the fact that one tadpole was different from all the others. He didn't seem to have the same priorities as his colleague tadpoles. Spent a lot of time, in fact, reading from a very large book with a black cover. If you looked at the book very carefully, you could just make out on the spine, it said, "The Life History of a Frog." One day, some of his friends came to see this deviant tadpole to find out just, you know, what was wrong with him. "Well," he said, "it's like this. I've been reading in this big book. It says in this book we're not going to remain tadpoles all our lives." "We're not?" "No, no. One day, we're all going to become frogs and go and live in the air. It says so in this book." "Stuff and nonsense," they said. "Where did you get such fairy tales from?" "Well," he said, the big frog once jumped down into the pond, you know. He's the creator of us all. He made us all after his own image. The great frog jumped down into the pond and gave us this book. He said there's not much point sort of laying up tadpole treasure in the pond. Because one day we're going to be frogs and live in the air. We're no use up there." Oh yes, they say. "And where did this frog go to, pray, after he'd given you the book?" "Well, he jumped back out of the pond, of course." "Out of the pond? Out of the pond? Nowhere's out of the pond. The pond is all there is." At this point, a rather distinguished and arrogant-looking tadpole swam forward, waving his Cambridge University tie. "Our scientists have investigated every corner of the pond, and I assure you there are no frogs to be found anywhere, let alone air. It's all mythological nonsense. We have proven conclusively that we evolved from a primeval spawn. We have located the residues of it in a distant part of the pond and proven conclusively that's where we all came from. There are no frogs. There's no air." Yet you and I know that that deviant little tadpole, in spite of the fact that his was definitely the minority opinion, and most of them thought it was ludicrous to believe in such mythological ideas as frogs and air in a scientific day when they had proven that they had evolved from primeval spawn, Wiener, he was the only frog, he was the only tadpole whose life really made sense. Because he was the only tadpole who really knew who he was and where he was going. He could do things with his life that had significance, where the others could only bum around. He knew who he was and where he was going. That's why we need the book. And that's why all the scientific theories in the world will never be a substitute